Good morning. A wish for a new home sounds like something out of a holiday movie. For the state's leading food pantry, it's a necessity before it has to close its doors. We'll talk with the co-director of Feeding Hawaii Together, Diana Lorenz. And as we do every Tuesday, we'll get Neil Conan's take on the news later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. In his new book, The People's Race, Behind the Scenes at the Honolulu Marathon, sports reporter Michael Tsai looks at a local event that just grew and grew. And the Marine Forces Pacific Band teams up with local artists for a Christmas benefit concert. We'll talk with Band Director Chief Warrant Officer Brian Sherlock.
It's a Tuesday, November 22nd, and that's the conversation coming up right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning.
You know, the holidays are not the time to be thinking about losing one of our capabilities to feed Hawaii's hungry, right?
No, they're not. And that's exactly why we're wondering why this has kind of gone on so long. You know, a few months ago, we talked with a Kaka'ako nonprofit that had just announced that it would close its doors unless a new location could be found. Now, as you remember, that closure date was supposed to be the end of the year. Well, that's only about a month away now. And Feeding Hawaii Together is no closer to having a new home. The organization is the largest distributor for the Hawaii Food Bank. They say 50,000 families depend on the warehouse in Kaka'ako to get their food. Diana and Charlie Lorenz are the co-founders of the nonprofit that they started in 2003. And Diana joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris, I believe it is, and Beth Ann. I thank you so much for this privilege to send out the word about, again, our mission, but also our dire need of a new location.
Right, Diane, I know that we talked with you a while ago. It'll just be me on this end of the phone. But as we talked of several months ago, there was a hope that a new location would be found fairly quickly. But so far, nothing. And here you are, you know, a little better than a month away from having to shut down. There has been a great deal of publicity about the organization. We've seen different segments on that. But has anybody come to you at all with a viable idea of where you could go?
Yes. You know, our biggest challenge is, of course, finding a new location, but it's the finances to actually support it is our biggest challenge. But I must put a great thank you out to many of our city officials and our senators, such as Carol Fukunaga and also Ann Kobayashi, Craig, and a community member, Sharon, also Daniel at HCDA. They are all working very, very hard, and plus even Senator Marcus, working hard to find something for us. We were really blessed to find out with Senator Marcus to have a building up in Wahiawa for storage, if that is the case. Because we will continue to search, even if we need to store our things and continue on in our search.
If you have to store everything up in Wahiawa and keep the search going, what will that mean for the people who are so used to coming into the Kaka'ako warehouse to be able to get food?
Well, that is our biggest concern. Our clients are so important to us. And that they do ask daily when we're open, you know, where are you guys going and so forth. This is going to create a hole in the community for those people that are housed, that are living paycheck to paycheck, and getting these fresh foods that we do provide. You know, there's other food pantries in the area that we are in, but we are a grocery store style pantry that gives them dignity of walking through with a shopping cart and picking out what they need. And eliminating waste of a lot of this food that's donated to Hawaii Food Bank, which is our distributor of all the food to the pantry. So it is a big concern for these families, senior citizens, and disabled. So there will be a great pull on the other pantries that are located in this area, and we need to really stay open in the area that we desire to be in, which is in Kaka'ako,
so
to meet this great need.
I mean, Diane, let's look at different scenarios. Let's say you have to be storing what you have there in, you know, what looks like a grocery store type warehouse situation. And then, as you say, there's going to be greater demand for produce and other foods at the pantries that are serving some of the same population that you do. Is there any plan in place to be able to work in concert with them or to be able to help, you know, stream the food there so that the food gets to people and you don't have to warehouse or warehouse as much?
Yes, we won't be storing food. We'll be storing our equipment. But there is a great opportunity with Hawaii Food Bank, who has a program named Ohana. You may see this in certain parks or certain churches where a large, you know, refrigerated truck comes and they need to distribute all that food out in one day. So there's opportunities to perhaps, you know, do this at Mother Walden's Park if we get that permit. But, of course, that may not really meet the great need because we have to get it all out that one day. And it's a lot of the seniors may not be able to get to that park, or they'll be not willing to stand in the sun for a long time and so forth. And then they're just given, you know, here, this is what you need, you know, and take so much. So they might be, you know, having to throw some of this away at home because it's, you know, we have to pull that all out in one day. But there is that opportunity, yes.
Well, I mean, you obviously are having to look at contingency plans because of, you know, you may be able to find a space, but as you say, affordability is the real issue. And if it's not affordable and you do have to store your equipment someplace else and stream the food as you can to whatever places are still available, that obviously is a contingency plan that you're working on. Is there also another plan? Is there any other place that you might be able to be even temporarily?
Yes, there is some works, like I mentioned, with HCDA and our city and so forth, but we just haven't gotten the fine line, and hopefully we'll learn from them in the middle of December about, you know, these opportunities, but I can't really say at this time.
So mid-December, you may get some other answers, but that would only be a temporary plan, a temporary fix?
Well, one of them would is offered if it's available for 3 years, and that's enough time to keep on looking and raising funds, which is the most important thing, because what we're facing is 10,000 to 15,000 monthly rent with some of these buildings. And that is so high. And also, it's so high to actually give out, though I do know that's, you know, what these landlords and the property owners are requesting. But that's a lot of money to give out and not go to a program.
You know,
so we're looking, you know, trying to find something that can help everybody.
You know, Diana, we have to go into a second, but I mean, we always think about ourselves as being such a generous lot and having concern for each other as we're all out here in the middle of the Pacific together. It may be hard for some people to believe that there just isn't a place that would be offered to you at a reasonable rent because of the service that you provide. Are you astounded at that too?
In a way, yes, we're astounded that we're not getting that many financial response and so forth. So I'm not sure what the reason might be. It might be that perhaps they think we're going to attract homeless encampments, which we never have. I want to say that our clients, 80% to 90% are house people, just, you know, paycheck to paycheck.
People who are on fixed incomes.
Yes, low-income people, fixed-income people, families.
All right, Diana, well, we wish you all the best, and we'll check back with you in a couple of weeks. Hope you have better
Thank
news
you.
Then.
Mm-hmm.
Diana Lorenz is the Assistant Director and Co-Founder of Feeding Hawaii Together. And since its beginning, the organization has grown to become the state's leading food pantry and Hawaii Food Bank's largest distributor. It's being evicted at the end of this year and is searching to find a new home. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a look behind the scenes at the Honolulu Marathon. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
This Thursday is Thanksgiving,
a holiday that celebrates the generosity shown to early European settlers of North America by Native American tribes of present-day Massachusetts. The holiday's traditions and date have evolved over the years, but a large communal feast has always been a fixture. For today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about another November holiday feast whose origins are here in Hawaii. The day in question is a commemoration of the founding of the Anglican Church of Hawaii, also called the Church of Hawaii. You'll remember that the Anglican Church was founded in 16th century England when Henry VIII renounced papal authority in order to secure an annulment of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. That faith was brought to Hawaii centuries later by one of Hawaii's sovereigns, and its members now celebrate that the king and his queen with a feast day. Can you give us the name of that holiday? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Hi, good morning. I'm Andy Char from Bluegrass Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
The sometimes uneasy relationship between money and athletics is one that Michael Tsai has had plenty of opportunities to observe during his career as a Hawaii sports reporter. His new book about the Honolulu Marathon, The People's Race, Inc., Behind the Scenes at the Honolulu Marathon, charts the evolution of a small community-focused event into a $100 million juggernaut. And Mike is with us in our studio. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
In some ways, the contemporary sports world seems one to have maybe lost its innocence, in a sense.
Sure, I think I'd agree with that. And as we were talking about before we came on, the influence of money, like you said, like Cyndi Lauper said, does change everything.
Yeah.
And I think with this particular event, you can see a very clear line in how it diverged from its origins as a community race that was focused on community health.
Yeah.
And sort of radical ideas about the efficacy of long-distance running.
Marathoning was really catching on with the body public, not just with, a select group of sports enthusiasts, but it was really spreading. And what, 85 was the first year?
I think 1973 was the first year that the marathon was staged, mm-hmm. and that was right after the 1972 Olympics in Munich when Frank Shorter won the marathon and kicked off the first American running revolution,
mm-hmm.
and that spurred the that whole big craze of jogging in the 70s.
Sure,
and then a second wave hit in the 80s. And continued on, through much of the 90s, when people like me would start to get into racing, these non-athletes who, through proper training, found that they could actually go this distance that was, sort of mythical in the minds of American sports fans.
And in the minds of the organizers of the marathon, this was an event that essentially promoted running is good for you.
Right. It was initially promoted as running is good for you, and then it became, and this was part of the original founder, Dr. Jack Scaff's plan, not just good for you, but fun.
Yeah.
And that, for him, that was sort of the secret to getting people out there was to trick them into doing this thing that was healthy for them, but was actually a lot of fun.
And it wasn't that much emphasis on who the winner would be, what the time would be, right?
Right. Yeah. One of the things that made the marathon a broad participatory sport was this kind of cleaving of time from distance. And mm-hmm. so we no longer cared about time. We cared about covering that distance,
yeah.
26.2 miles. And so, you know, whether you did it in, you know, 2:10, like the best athletes, or whether you did it, you know, in 4 or 5 hours,
yeah.
It became sort of an individually defined goal.
Idea was to get that T-shirt marathon finisher, right?
That's the magic, right? That's what everybody chases, the T-shirt.
Well, once money gets involved with human activities, the temptation to cheat comes along, right?
Sure, sure.
And we had a little skullduggery in past marathons, yeah?
Right. I mean, the influence of money first appears with the Honolulu Marathon in the form of sponsorships and the kinds of compromises or sacrifices and control that you make to attract and retain that sponsorship. But it trickles down, of course, to the athletes. And so I believe it was 2008. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a women's winner who, after the fact, had tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that test was based on a random out-of-competition sample that was taken before the marathon. And so she was not able to be disqualified. But the following year, the men's winner was also tested positive, and that resulted in a default. And so the Honolulu Marathon, like many other marathons, many other sporting events, has been touched by this taint of cheating or bending of rules in order to get a chance at these prize purses, which are pretty considerable nowadays.
Well, one of the since Honolulu doesn't have a rail rapid transit system, nobody could do what Rosie Ruiz did and take the subway,
right?
But that was a famous episode of the New York Marathon where somebody literally took the train and was deemed the winner, right?
Right, right. And then later that year got caught in Boston as well, doing the same thing.
Rosie Ruiz. A lot of nerve, right? We had an imposter in the Honolulu Marathon, yeah.
That was one of the more interesting incidents in the history of the Honolulu Marathon. And, you know, when you are hosting upwards of 30,000 people every year for 40 years, you get to get these very strange, bizarre, unexpected events.
Yeah.
And so back in the mid-80s, there was a runner named David Sebe. And we first got to know him as Brant Nava, a supposed Peruvian runner who came out of nowhere, almost won the race, probably would have won the race had he not pulled up short of the finish line. And in the aftermath of this, people were wondering who this person was. I mean, he had a high race number, which means that he wasn't one of the recognized elites.
Mm-hmm.
The great American runner, Alberto Salazar, went up to him afterwards and tried to speak to him in Spanish. And Brant Nava just sort of looked at him blankly.
The only Peruvian who didn't speak any Spanish.
The only Peruvian who couldn't speak Spanish. And he also had a manager who was a supposed a Greek agent. And as it turned out, through some really good reporting by a local reporter, Pat Beigold, it turned out that they were both South African. And this was during the time of the athletic ban against South African athletes due to the apartheid system. And so even though he was a black South African, someone who was, I guess, doubly victimized, he was not able to compete on the world stage. And so they had perpetrated this hoax.
So in that case, that wasn't as much about prize money as in just getting to compete at all.
Yeah, trying to get him out there to compete. It turned out that his agent, a guy named Paul Kester, had been doing this for a lot of South African athletes. Part of it was money, the prize money.
Sure.
But also giving these athletes an opportunity to compete on the world stage and really show what they could do. And one of the interesting things after that was once the ban was lifted, the Honolulu Marathon actually brought David Sebe back to Honolulu to compete and gave him a share of the prize money that he would have won had he been eligible the first time he ran.
This time he ran under his real name.
His real name and again performed very well and was one of the top runners in the world in the later part of his career when he was able to run legally.
Well, Mike, one of the things that's really fun about the book is the way the story of one event becomes the story of a lot of things in Hawaii. And I thank you for coming in.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Tsai is a reporter and columnist for the Honolulu Star-Advertiser and the author of The People's Race, Inc., Behind the Scenes at the Honolulu Marathon, from the University of Hawaii Press.
Hawaii Public Radio is grateful for the support of our listeners and for our many community partners, including Evergreen by Deborah, Hawaii Arts Alliance, and Punahou Journalism Students. Thank you all so much for your generosity and participation during our recent on-air campaign. It's pretty clear that the president-elect has very different ideas about the environment from the legacy of President Obama. What could that mean for Hawaii? Well, that's today's reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, I mean, there's a lot of conjecture about what the administration that's going to be invested as of next January will actually do. But what we do know now, at least, is that the feds have played a great part in Hawaii's environmental enforcement and certainly funding. So that's got to be making a lot of both local government folks and the environmental community quite nervous.
They are. And our Nathan Eagle talked to quite a lot of people, a very well-rounded story. Yeah, we rely heavily on federal support. I'm thinking in particular of the EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, not just for money, but for enforcing the law. Now, we do know where Donald Trump stands on climate change. He thinks it's a hoax, that it's not real.
And that's the nice word that you can use.
Yes, it is. There are other words we could use as well, but we won't. He wants to pull out of the Paris Agreement on reducing carbon emissions. He wants to ease regulations on coal and oil and gas. All these things are not in line with the kind of attitude towards the environment that Hawaii has. So what should we do? Well, the folks that Nathan talked to said a couple of things. One, you got to rely on the lawyers. You're going to need a lot of legal help. You can certainly empower citizens group. But, you can also remind local decision makers that we have our own authority, our own laws that in many ways can protect us. And basically, maybe you need to help give more money to state and county agencies to be sort of a backstop to a Donald Trump presidency as well as a GOP-controlled Congress.
You're really saying that Hawaii needs to understand that perhaps it's going to have to take more responsibility to be, if not the final say, but the one that might prevent a final federal say or involvement.
Right. And the way David Hankin of Earth Justice put it was the fox has taken over the hen house, so it's important now that we take care of our own hen house. And think of the kind of problems we have. Ohia facing decimation by this fungus, the problems with all the cesspools we have, invasive species, and then just the number of storms that have increased recently in the Pacific. All these things illustrate how badly we're going to need federal support going forward, but we also need to do what we can here at home.
Really quickly, what does this mean, though, for clean energy?
Well, fortunately, a lot of people pointed to our 2045 goal, 100% renewable. They feel that that's going to remain the same. That's not going to change at the federal level. And remember also our state constitution, very strong when it comes to protecting the environment.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment, but this is going to be an ongoing conversation, don't you know?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thanks, Chad. Talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Now back to a different reality. Now, emboldened by his victory, President-elect Donald Trump has taken the news media to task, publicly embarrassed one of our most important allies, and met with a long list of business associates, advisors, and job seekers, including Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. And the Trump Twitter wars are back. News analyst Neil Conan joins us, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut Farm on the Big Island. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It was great to see you and the other HPR luminaries over in Hilo last Friday to celebrate the debut of HPR 2 on the east side of the island.
Well, you know, it was really good to see you, too, and thanks so much for making the two-hour drive. But meanwhile, we have seen some extraordinary developments in the presidential transition this past week. While President Obama took that farewell trip to Europe and went to the APEC summit in Peru, the president-elect showed that the next administration is going to be unlike any other. We got another lesson in that one. Instead of starting to disengage from his far-flung business interests, for example, he was meeting with investors, and his new hotel in Washington, D.C. has been soliciting foreign delegations. What do you make of this?
Yeah, there is no precedent here. I mean, there's a huge difference between putting the business affairs of George W. Bush or Barack Obama into a blind trust and the empire of hotels and real estate and golf courses that all bear the name of Trump. And while his advisors use the phrase blind trust, it's very hard to see how the president-elect or anybody else is not going to know what and where his businesses are. A big part of the plan is to turn over his empire to his children. Again, that is not the textbook definition of a blind trust. And his children continue to participate in political meetings as well, further bring the you know, that new hotel near the White House suggested that foreign delegations might want to stay at a Trump hotel to curry favor with the president. Again, advisors say no conflict of interest here, but so far they failed to convince even the politically friendly editorial board of the Wall Street Journal.
I want to talk to you more about Trump and the media in just a moment, but I want to talk to you about another major development now first, where Trump settled those three civil lawsuits on Trump University for $25 million. I think we were there watching that come through on Friday. These are those fraud cases brought by the former students who said that they were being ripped off.
Cases that, you remember, Trump repeatedly declared he was going to win when he went to court. Now, the settlement does not include any admission of wrongdoing by Trump, but to borrow one of his favorite phrases, a lot of people are saying that there are 25 million reasons to believe his case may have been less than airtight. But the cases are settled. The potential for embarrassment is limited. Don't forget, the biggest of these three cases was before Gonzalo Curiel, the federal judge Trump attacked for his Mexican heritage during the campaign. So that distraction is off the board as well.
Okay, now, but in between Twitter outbursts, the president-elect did make some progress on his transition. He named Senator Jeff Sessions as his attorney, or at least his choice for attorney general. You just mentioned Judge Curiel. Jeff Sessions was once rejected, though, wasn't he, as a federal judge by the same Senate Judiciary Committee that's going to be holding hearings on his nominations to head the Justice Department? Is that right?
Rejected for racially tinged remarks that, depending on who you listen to, were either intemperate or actively supportive of the Ku Klux Klan. Supporters say that was a long time ago, back in Alabama. Critics will not be so kind. The Senate, though, is notoriously deferential to its own, and I think unless something else comes up, there's no reason to believe that Senator Sessions will not be confirmed.
He was also an early supporter of Donald Trump, though, right? And I think the first member of Congress to endorse him. So, you know, so far it looks like loyalty is going a long way. You've got former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani. They're both reportedly up for important positions. Then again, he also met with his fiercest critic in the Republican Party. We saw the meeting with former presidential candidate Mitt Romney happening this week.
You know, President Lincoln famously had his team of rivals. Barack Obama appointed Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. But, you know, William Seward and candidate Hillary Clinton never used the invective that Romney used against Donald Trump as a fraud and a con artist. It's hard to see Trump rising above all that to name Mitt Romney as the office everybody's talking about for him as Secretary of State. and hard to see how these two men would work together, even if he did so.
Yesterday, Trump also met with Tulsi Gabbard. She's probably one of the most prominent Democrat he's seen so far. We hear that she was not offered a position, but could she be up for a job in the Trump administration?
You know, I don't think so. News outlets quoted unnamed sources as mentioning her for Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, or high positions in those agencies, or ambassador to the U.N. That's not likely to either be offered or accepted. As you know, she quit as deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee when she thought the DNC was favoring Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Leaked emails showed her to be right about that. She was a passionate supporter of Sanders. And, you know, that wing of the party is not going to be forgiving of what they would see as collaboration with Donald Trump. I would think that would burn a lot of bridges with the Democratic Party. She says she went to express her strong views on Syria, where she opposes President Obama's calls for President Assad to go, and said she wanted to get in her word against the idea of a no-fly zone or a safe zone in Syria, which she thinks might lead to a war with Russia.
Now, amid all of this presidential transition, we often forget that the war is continuing in Syria and that the Russian and Syrian forces resumed the bombing of Aleppo just a few days ago, too.
Yeah, just the day after the president-elect spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin. But let's not forget, Bashar al-Assad's international backers also include Iran and Hezbollah. His opponents include allies of the United States, like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. You know, Trump likes to say that Assad and the Russians are fighting ISIS in Syria, when quite clearly they're not. This is not simple. It's not clear-cut. It is not easy. Now, you can disagree with President Obama's reluctance to get the U.S. more deeply engaged in Syria, but you certainly can understand it.
We could go on for quite a while about this, but I got to get to this about the media. I mean, today's off-again and on-again meeting with the New York Times. Then there was this weekend's Twitter war with Saturday Night Live, that other tweet demanding that the cast of the Broadway musical Hamilton apologize to VP-elect Mike Pence, and then that extraordinary meeting yesterday where Trump called in a group of TV news personalities and executives for an off-the-record session, and it didn't stay off the record very long, did it?
No, it sure didn't. Right-wing media like Breitbart and the New York Post report this as Donald Trump standing up to the elite right to their face. He opened the meeting with a tirade against the news media as dishonest and corrupt. He picked out CNN and NBC in particular as unfair. NBC, apparently, because he thought they were using a picture of him that he found unflattering on their website. And the meeting, many thought, was, you know, called to calm the hard feelings from the campaign, was anything but. Now, for all the interviews that he's done, Trump has not held a news conference for months now. Some in the circle say he should deny the White House press credentials to media outlets that he thinks have been unfair, the same way he banned some news outlets from his campaign plane. And, you know, Trump has always been thin-skinned. You see that in his reaction to the Alex Baldwin mockery on Saturday Night Live. And no major news outlets have been more critical of him than the Washington Post and the New York Times. Today, as you mentioned, Trump suddenly canceled the scheduled meeting with the Times, then he uncanceled it. It is supposed to be happening right now, so we'll see how that goes. Oh, and speaking of uncanceling, this morning Kellyanne Conway said Trump is no longer interested in pursuing criminal charges against Hillary Clinton. So no special prosecutor and all those chants of lock her up, never mind.
Okay, well, we got to go in just a second, but I got to ask you about something else on his Twitter feed. He used one of his messages to tell the British government they should appoint Nigel Farage as an ambassador to the United States. What's up with that?
Yeah, Trump embarrassed Prime Minister Theresa May first by speaking with her only after speaking with eight other world leaders. And the first person he met with from overseas was Nigel Farage. Then he suggests that she appoint Farage as ambassador in a tweet. Now, Farage, of course, is a right-wing demagogue, the man who championed Brexit, now the acting head of the UKIP party, and maybe Prime Minister May's least favorite rival, a pal of Donald Trump's now, and he promotes his pal at the expense of the prime minister. He's going to need Prime Minister May's support on Ukraine and Syria and trade and China. This is short-sighted, doesn't begin to cover this.
And I wish we had more time to talk about it. We will, I know, in the future, but we got to leave it there for the moment. Thanks, Neil.
You bet, Bethann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from his MacNut farm. You can also hear any of our conversations on our archive at hawaiipublicradio.org. And, of course, you hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.
helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Contrary to popular belief, not all philanthropic giving has to do with money. Keiji Kawakami set a fine example of this. He was the son of Japanese immigrant laborers, and in World War II, he served in the famous 442nd Regimental Combat Team. After the war, he attended college and then founded the Iolani Sportswear Company. It rode the crest of the rising wave of Hawaii's tourist industry, and some of their aloha shirts have become collector's items. Then, as a successful businessman, he began collecting art and donated many pieces to venues such as the Honolulu Museum of Art, to several schools and important institutions around the state, including the Hawaii Community Foundation, who displays and maintains 9 of his sculptures. Keiji Kawakami gave us something more powerful than money, for viewing his art will make us all more fully human for a very long time to come. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
And now we're going to get back to today's backyard quiz. We asked you for the name of a holiday feast which commemorates the sovereigns who brought the Church of England to Hawaii. Those were Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma. Kamehameha IV was impressed by the splendor and the grandeur of the Anglican Church while traveling abroad, compared to the Spartan style of the American Protestant missionaries back in Hawaii. Queen Emma had grown up with a British grandfather and raised in an Anglican household. Their decision to invite the Anglican Church to Hawaii was also intended to curb the influence of American missionaries, who were widely seen as supporting American annexation of Hawaii. The Church of Hawaii was founded in 1862 and eventually became the official church of the monarchy. After the overthrow, the Church of Hawaii was dissolved and became the Episcopal Diocese of Hawaii, part of the Episcopal Church of the United States. Members of that congregation celebrate the Feast of the Holy Sovereigns every year on November 28th to remember the founding of their church and all the good works done by Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma. That's today's answer to the quiz. Nobody got it, so we'll keep our prize and we'll try again tomorrow. It's now 8:48.
One of the better-kept musical secrets in our islands is the Marine Forces Pacific Band, which makes its home at Marine Corps Base, Hawaii. A versatile, highly proficient group of young musicians trained to perform in a wide variety of styles, from classical compositions to jazz, rock and roll, and back again. Its community mission comes to the fore in this weekend's Toys for Tots Christmas Concert, a program of holiday music that places local artists in front of the band for a free family event. Chief Warrant Officer Brian Sherlock is the band's director, and we spoke with him about the upcoming show.
This is our 9th iteration of this concert, and the idea happened, well, you know, give us a little time to plan. About 10 years ago, we got the idea that we live in such a rich musical culture out here, and unfortunately, the military bands, I think, sort of isolate themselves, maybe not intentionally, but we don't get a lot of interaction with all these wonderful local musicians that we have here in Hawaii, and so the idea came that we should be doing music together with the natives here and the local musicians. So a Christmas concert seemed like the great idea. Of course, we've been supporting Toys for Tots for over 50 years, mm-hmm. and I just think it's one of the best charities there is out there, and it's a great opportunity for us to give a little bit back to the community at the same time. By benefiting some of the local keiki that otherwise might not have so bright a Christmas.
Well, you know, Brian, I'm one of the people who became aware of what you folks do musically through these concerts, and it really is a shame that the community doesn't know more about what you do.
Right, Chris, you were in one of the very first concert, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're right. It is. I mean, a lot of what we do is behind the gates on base. But we do try to get out. I've always said I think our real value to the Marine Corps is in the public, reminding the public of our Marine Corps that we have here, and showing that friendlier side of what we do. So we do try to get out into the public quite a bit. Sometimes it's difficult because there's so much going on musically in Honolulu and around Oahu that oftentimes we're competing against the very musicians we'd like to be enjoying ourselves.
But actually, schedules permitting, you do make yourself available to community events as long as they don't charge money. Is that still the policy?
That is exactly correct. All it takes is a phone call or an email or a letter, and we often support things over at the Bishop Museum. We do a lot with schools out in the public. All it takes is somebody to ask, and as long as it's a free and open to the public event, we're happy to help.
One of the things that to me, you know, especially when you get out in the public to these public events that you folks exemplify, is the whole idea of combining what is associated with Marine Corps discipline with musician discipline. They're not that different, are they?
You're exactly correct. We had a young Marine just recently that distinguished herself as a really excellent marksman. So she got to actually travel with certain people from all over the Marine Corps and compete as a marksman. And she brought that up in a few interviews as well, that same kind of practice, that same kind of laser focus, that same kind of discipline, like you say, you know, is what makes a good musician as well.
To be in the Marine Forces Pacific Band, what do you have to do? What does it take to become a member?
Right. Well, all of our musicians were auditioned and approved as musicians before they ever even joined the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. So we have specific music recruiters out and about throughout the country that will do those auditions for people who are interested. Then the typical training is normal Marine Corps. You go to 13 weeks of boot camp, actual Marine Corps boot camp, and you know, you get to roll around in the dirt and get yelled at.
Yeah.
And we follow that with a few weeks of combat training, and then the Marines are sent off to our tri-service music school. So that's the School of Music, which is at Norfolk, Virginia, where we share a schoolhouse with the Navy and the Army. So there's about a six-month training evolution that happens there, very much like maybe your first year in a music program at a university,
mm-hmm.
but it's just crammed into 6 months. And then they are assigned to one of 10 bands throughout the Marine Corps based on just the needs, where we have a particular opening for whatever instrument that musician may play.
Sure. And then at each one of those 10 locations, you fan out into the surrounding community quite a bit, yeah?
That's exactly right. And it varies from band to band as to their mission. Some of the we've got two bands that are stationed with infantry divisions. They may have a little bit different mission than what, what we have out here in the Pacific, or what you may have at Headquarters Marine Corps in Quantico, Virginia. This just slightly different, but, you know, the overall picture is pretty much the same.
And I know that in the past, you folks have traveled throughout the Asia-Pacific area on a kind of a public, what you call it, kind of a public awareness mission, yeah?
Yes, that's exactly right. One of the real values, as I say, that we have here in the Pacific is that we can be that friendly face of the United States Marine Corps in foreign countries. We can oftentimes open doors for diplomacy that Marine Corps might not otherwise be able to open, you know, from a weapons and boots standpoint. So, we've done quite a bit of travel in the past, you know, especially when we had that pivot to the Asia Pacific during the Obama administration. There was a lot of opportunities for us to really try to, you know, represent the United States and be diplomatic in the way that we, like I say, got to visit and interact with not only militaries but diplomats and just the general public in many of the Asia Pacific countries.
And do you feel that response when you've been on those trips? Do you get it back from the audience?
Oh yes, definitely. I'm always amazed wherever we go how warm the reception is for, you know, not like I say, a lot of times we're maybe the only Americans that somebody has seen in maybe Palau or one of the smaller nations, Tonga,
mm-hmm.
And not infrequently we're the only military personnel from the United States that a lot of people would see. And I think that's a great representation. You know, there's more to the United States and the Marine Corps than just running around invading and blowing things up.
And of course, you know, the whole intersection of music and the military goes back to practically the dawn of armed forces, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, even when the Marine Corps was founded, we had fifers and drummers right out front in any column going into battle. So that's really the origin. But as you know, the president's own Marine Band in D.C. has been there since the administration of Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it's a long and illustrious history.
Chief Warrant Officer Brian Sherlock is the director of the Marine Forces Pacific Band, which is performing a free holiday concert, Toys for Tots, this Saturday and Sunday at the Hawaii Theater in downtown Honolulu. Guest artists include Henry Kapono, Keahi Conjugation, Eddie Ortiz, gospel singer Melissa Collison, and comedian Bo Irvine. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. You know, Bethann, when you talk with Neil Conan, it gives a really valuable perspective in terms of precedent set by current events. And in this case, the precedents being broken by the president-elect in terms of meetings with foreign leaders, protocols involved, that kind of thing.
And what does it say that there might be people who, media folks who would be banned from the White House press corps simply because the president-elect is not happy with the way in which he's being reflected in that, or even with all the SNL stuff. I mean, we've always made fun of presidents. It goes back as long,
yeah.
I think, as SNL's been around, and before that, too. And there comes a point where you just hopefully would think that the president would have enough of his own ego intact to be able to withstand all of that, but the business about, the double chins and all the other stuff,
yeah,
that we heard this morning on NPR News, it's got to make you wonder.
If you thought the presidency was a refuge from ridicule and criticism, you're
in the wrong business.
Somewhat mistaken, yeah.
Well, we are going to carry on with our business, and we will be back with you tomorrow morning right back here at 8 o'clock. And we're going to be talking with OEVTV's Na'alehu Anthony, who's being very thoughtful about Disney's Moana and wondering whether this is a service to the Polynesian culture or perhaps not. We're going to talk to him tomorrow. And we'll also continue with our ongoing series, The Last Job in Hawaii.
And Mary Poppins will levitate to Maui on stage.
We like to hear from you, and you're always able to call us on our talkback line. It's 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of the show or want a pass one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. See you in the morning with more of The Conversation.